Hey Trailblazers, this is Jason, your host of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. Before we jump into our latest episode, I've got some incredible news for you. Are you gearing up for your next big hike or backpacking trip? Well, we at Trailblazing Texas podcast have partnered up with Trekker Joe's, the ultimate Texas outfitter, to bring you something I feel absolutely special. Listeners, you of the Trailblazing Texas podcast can now get a one-time 15% off their gear purchases at Trekker Joe's. That's right. Whether you're a first-time customer at Trekker Joe's or a repeat customer like me, you can save big and hit the trails well-prepared. So upon checkout, use code TTP15 to claim your 15% discount and in the process support an amazing local Texas business. So happy trails, and don't forget to tell your hiking buddies. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode. So, Ryan, what do you think is the hardest decision you've ever had to make in the mountains?
That's a good question. I don't know that I've ever had to make a particularly hard decision. I'll just throw this out there. I've been bitten by dogs twice, and I did pull my gun, and I almost shot one once. I don't think either decision would have been wrong. That was definitely justified, but I didn't because I wanted to continue enjoying my weekend. We were just backpacking in for a 3-day trip and the owners were eventually able to recall it and it was messy, but I didn't shoot it. So I don't know. I think if I did shoot it, I would have had to hike out and talk to the sheriff and all that stuff. Probably go get rabies shots. I don't know what else would have happened, but it would have been whole ordeal.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I didn't, but I could have.
I experience wild dogs every Sunday because I'm usually hiking on the Lone Star hiking trail. It's and both endpoints are about an hour from my house. It's the longest trail in Texas. It's like 128 miles with all the loops and 96.4 if you just hike through it. And there's wild dogs. People drop off dogs out in the trailheads, and there's wild dogs all over. And luckily, I've not been bit, but there's been some times where I was like, man, why didn't I bring my gun? Because, you know, they run up on you. And, yeah, I don't know that, yeah, it would be hard for me to pull the trigger on a dog. But, man, they
the wilderness area with leash law. Yeah. The dog was off leash. I didn't see the owners at first. It went straight for the leg.
I mean, yeah, he still has a scar. Like,
yeah, it dove right in there. And I was wearing pretty heavy pants. I think it was my Beta ARs, Gore-Tex pants. And yeah, it was going for it. So, I mean, you know, that's a tough decision in the moment.
So what are the gun laws in Colorado? So like, you know, Texas, we have open carry and we have concealed carry license, and I don't know if it's changed for national parks, but I know state parks, I believe that you can carry. What about you guys?
You can conceal carry with a permit everywhere except for Boulder County, I think.
Armand P.
By and large, you can conceal and open carry in Armand P. And you can open carry anywhere, you can conceal carry anywhere, just not Boulder County. Other than post offices, you know, government buildings, things like that. So probably very similar to your laws.
Yeah, they're pretty lenient in terms of like where they allow you to bring a firearm in Colorado.
One time I came home from hiking, and I don't want to get political on the podcast, but I ran into someone and they were in a left or a right direction, but like way out here. So I had about a 30-minute conversation with them. I got home, and the first thing I said to my wife is, man, I met this guy. This guy was nuts. And I was just telling her about the conversation. And so we're laughing about it. The next weekend, we go back to the same trail because it's really Trailhead 6, and you dump out to a lake. So it's really pretty, especially if you catch it early with the sunrise. And it's not hunting season, but in Texas, you can hunt hog all year round, but you're not supposed to hunt off the trail, even though it's you know, Sam Houston National Forest, and there's deer stand out there and people hunt out there. And so we're walking and I'm looking ahead and I said, Lori, like, there's that crazy guy that I told you I met last weekend. And she's like, no way. And so the guy that this, I said, yeah. So we're walking and this guy has an AR-15 and he's just walking down the trail, like no shoulder strap, no nothing. Just
for show.
Yeah, I'm like, how uncomfortable. You know, I'm like, I'm bitching if my base weight is 10 pounds and, you know, this guy's carrying this, no shoulder strap. And we got the biggest laugh. At first, it was kind of alarming because you usually would never see anybody with a gun on the trail, you know, especially a rifle, because you're not supposed to hunt off the trail and stuff. But, you know, it was alarming. But then, you know, we after I looked back and made sure he kept walking that way, it was kind of, it fit the story, and it made it even better that, you know, that I told Lori the weekend before. So Kira, how has mountaineering changed your perspective on risk versus reward?
I have friends that definitely have a much higher risk tolerance for certain aspects of the mountain than I do, and I think you just end up working up to it. Like, you don't really know what your tolerance is until you find it. And ideally you're still staying safe. But, you know, as I've worked up, I have a pretty high risk tolerance for things like route finding. I'm very comfortable on steep snow. So I've learned that, you know, my risk tolerance may start out down low, but if I prepare, you know, I can bump that up as I go along to where, you know, I can be doing things now that 10 years ago, I would have been like, oh, you know, I'm never going to use a rope on a mountain, right? It's like, I'm never going to do anything where I need to rope up. And then you gradually build up a skill set where it's like, okay, roping up is now not this huge, big step up. It's now sort of a progression. So like my risk tolerance just just changed as I've gone along.
Ryan, and this question's for you. You've accomplished a ton in Colorado and other places. To me, just if I just give it a quick thought, I almost, if I didn't know anything else, I would guess that at times that you have, it's almost like a thru hiker, like you're on this trail for so long, you've accomplished this goal that you had, and then after you've accomplished the list or the 100 highest or all the 14ers, do you ever have any kind of, I guess you could say, post-adventure blues? Or, you know, I don't know if that's the right terminology, but, you know, like, you just, it's almost like, okay, well, what's next? Or, man, I feel lost. I need some other cool stuff to do.
Right. I think we definitely experienced that, as I mentioned previously, after we finished the 14ers. And there was a huge void because we'd only been accelerating to finish them. And then all of a sudden, wow, we're better at this than we've ever been. And we don't have any more. So what are we supposed to do? And so through the process of doing the 13ers year round, we just keep picking up new skill sets to learn. And, you know, we've gotten into ski mountaineering more. I don't recall off the top of my head how many true ski descents we have. I know it's over 30, which it is between 13ers and 14ers.
True off the summit. No, it's like 16 for me.
Is it 16?
Yeah.
Okay. What am I thinking? I'm thinking of calendar winter.
Yeah, you're thinking of winter.
Calendar, either way. So doing things in calendar, backpacking, you know, in the winter. And, you know, we've done a little tiny bit of ice climbing. Rock climbing is a new and different thing. Mixed climbing is a new and different thing. Steep snow, glacier travel, large volcanoes like Shasta. eventually Rainier and beyond, who knows? All of those things are a unique skill set. It's a unique approach. It's different preparation. It's different, physical requirements to do those things. And on top of it, everything else that has to do with the trip, staying at cool Airbnbs, going to hot springs, getting good food, all of that provides plenty of variety. We're really not running out of peaks anytime soon in Colorado. We can keep doing this for quite a few years.
Yeah, you said 583.
Ranked.
There's
788 if you count unranked. So it just depends on what list
you want. It depends on how you want to break down the lists. But either way, we're going for the ranked summits. So yeah, we've done almost 200 ranked out of the 583 plus the 14ers. So 636 total is the current list that we're working on, and that will take a while.
So Kira, same question. You've run out of the list. How do you handle it?
I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I should pick up some new skills. So I picked up skiing. I picked up rock climbing. I want to get more into glacier travel. I just sort of like, if I can't do that anymore, then I'll pivot. If it's winter, it's like, okay, well, I need to pivot. I can't go rock climbing, so I'll go do something else. I generally just find other outdoor activities to pivot to throughout the year. If I end up ending a list or the season ends for one thing, I pivot to another thing. So I always have like something I'm kind of hopping around doing.
It's interesting to me to hear your answers on that question, because you are all year round able to do stuff. Here in Texas, we have, and I'm sure you guys as well, but 100 degree heat, and I'm old, I'm in my 50s, and that's unsafe. I definitely have a depression in the summertime. I hate summer. This summer is the first summer in probably 5 or 6 years where I've tried to push and still go out, not on backpacking trips, but, for sure hiking. We have, I indoor rock climb. And what I found out is maybe it wasn't so much of the heat. That was just kind of excuse, but we have these damn horse flies.
I've heard about that.
Like these things are like this, and they bite and suck blood, and they're just all over the place. So, I always use the excuse, it's the heat. But I really started doing some deep diving, and I think it's just the damn horse flies. And subconsciously, I just know I don't want to be out there with them, because it's absolutely miserable. But yeah, all joking aside, it's neat to see that you guys have all year round. And, I'm sure in Texas, yes, but it's just the heat and horse flies.
There are definitely times of the year where we tend to have a trip booked somewhere else because it's generally horrible in Colorado weather-wise. So we do try to be like, okay, well, maybe let's book a trip somewhere else this time of year, so we have something to look forward to elsewhere.
Yeah. It's worth noting that part of the whole thing is still getting to the trailhead. And for us, it's close-ish because it's in Colorado, but the San Juans are still 7.5 hours away each way, So it's not like it's just easy for us to drive an hour to the mountains every weekend. It could be if we wanted to just go to RMNP all the time, but we're still a very, very long ways away from the majority of mountains in Colorado.
Yeah.
And it's just like for me in the quads, it's a 10-hour drive for me going 85 miles an hour. And I'll drive up like on a Thursday night, get there Friday, hike Friday, Saturday, and come back. Yeah, I don't even think twice about it.
Right. Yeah, that's how we are. We do it every weekend. So we're pretty darn used to it at this point. But it still adds to the, exertion of the whole thing.
So this question is for both of y'all. And for as long as you guys have been climbing together and married, I can definitely, my wife, she'll hike with me. She'll do an overnighter just one night in the backcountry just because she's not going to poop in the woods. So she figures she can hold it. But you're married, you're living together. You guys don't have to say anything, and you can just read each other's mind. When you're on a trail, a climb, and you can tell that the other one is struggling, what do you do? Do you find it that it's your job to kind of help motivate them to kind of push through that? How do y'all handle that?
First of all, I would say we cannot read each other's minds at all. No. Communication is shockingly hard in a marriage. Turns out you actually have to tell the person how you're feeling. So we actually cannot read each other's minds.
But I don't think either of us are good motivators.
Oh, horrible. I am not a nice person.
But we both have the same understanding that, okay, we're going to get through this. We're not going to bail. We're going to be fine. It's going to work out. Let's just keep going. And then we keep going. Like, and then we get to the summit and we get back to the car and we go have a beer and it's good.
Yeah, I've definitely tried to be motivating, but it does not come off as motivating. It comes off as me being not nice.
But I'm also not that susceptible to motivation. I'm looking at all the objective facts. I'm going to grind through it. I'll be fine. And sometimes morale is low, but it doesn't affect our ability to be successful. We're not going to just turn around because we're both in a bad mood, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I try to motivate some of my hiking partners, and it doesn't really go well. And everybody that I hike and climb with, they're in their 30s. I'm in my 50s. So you can already tell that, you know, they've already left me. I'm usually by myself, so I have to motivate myself to push through it. So this is also for kind of both of y'all. How does trust come into, you know, like you guys being together on these adventures? You're probably at times roped in with each other. You're like, I couldn't even imagine, you know, seeing your wife on a ridge or on longs, you know, in the narrows, and it's slippery and just kind of like, then there's nothing you can do. You're just like, you know, go honey, go. How does that play into the trips that you do? And it's got to build trust between you guys, right? Your lives are in each other's hands.
I mean, we treat each other like we would treat each other the same as any other partner on a hike. Like, we don't really, it doesn't make a difference that we're a married couple. It's like, this is my hiking partner for the day. Same as we were to hike with someone else or in a group of four or three, whatever, like we're partners for the day. I feel like.
I would say because we've climbed with each other more than a lot of people have climbed with anyone, you know, it definitely builds a sense of trust that I know that she knows what she's doing and she knows that I know what I'm doing. And we both know that we're both comfortable on this. We don't really do much that we're truly uncomfortable. We are mature enough in our, you know, perspective to pick objectives that are appropriate for our skill set, and that's what we go for. And it gets a little bit spicy at times, but at the same time, we're both generally very calm and collected and comfortable on the terrain that we're on. So from the difficulty of the climbs themselves, that's not a huge question mark. You know, we know that we're both capable and comfortable, and that's all we need to know.
I mean, it does impact. I think in the winter, there's definitely more choices that are made. Like, the reality of being a group of two in avalanche terrain is, like, if Ryan got in an avalanche, the chances of me alone finding him and actually being able to dig him out, even with the right skills and training, are almost zero. So we are having to make more conservative decisions than if we were in a bigger group, maybe, for certain objectives. Like, we're definitely going to be way more conservative about avalanche terrain because it's just the two of us. Sometimes, like, if something happens, it's probably not going to be survivable. So we stay conservative, you know, maybe more than other people would.
Yeah. I know, looking at y'all's adventures and pictures, man, if that's conservative, woo. You guys do some epic stuff. So I think this is, I love this question. And I'm just thinking of it in my life. You see a lot of couples that don't share a passion with anything. You know, this person is over here doing that. This person's over here doing that. So what is it like for you guys to share this passion of adventure, of mountaineering as a couple together?
I think it's really helpful to have just a shared objective in a relationship, just an invariably shared, we're going to work together to figure out what's going to be successful this weekend and have a really good process of doing it. I think early on, we were probably complacent in our planning a little bit in ensuring that we were doing something that we both wanted to do. But at this point, we can both agree, hey, we want to climb something above 13,000 feet this weekend, or we want to ski something, or we want to, you know, do X, Y, or Z. And that gives us a very productive outlet for our constructive energy in the relationship. So I think generally, on average, it helps more than it applies pressure. So, you know, and especially when we have a string of successful weekends that are all fun and exciting, that's how most of our, you know, summer and fall weekends are. It's motivating for us to, you know, continue climbing and continue being constructive with each other. And yeah, that's what I'd say.
Yeah. I mean, other couples, like, I mean, most of my friends, they're in very long-term relationships, and normally they have like a shared goal that they're doing together. I don't know a lot of friends where the couples are doing totally different things. Most of the people we know, our close friends, they're like, maybe it's travel, or maybe it's like they really love home renovation, or they're really into skiing. Like, they usually have like a shared thing that they're doing together almost every weekend.
Yeah. Okay. Looking at, I guess, the overall process of planning something, do you guys find that each of you kind of have a role that you normally, like, I'm always the planner, or I'm the navigator, or I'm the risk manager. Like, do y'all have your own roles and responsibilities, or is it just kind of?
I think we share the responsibility of finding objectives because we both see different content on social media. A lot of our suggestions come from, especially in the winter when it's more difficult. A lot of that comes from, hey, I saw this group did this. Okay. They did it last weekend. These were their notes. I found their GPX file on the forum. You know, I talked to them and they said this was great or this was horrible. And we can kind of put all of that information together. Sometimes we have totally different sources of information. We can put that together and just paint a Venn diagram and figure out what seems like we have the best information. How are we going to proceed from here? So I think our roles in that part of the planning are pretty similar. We both look at the weather. We both download the GPX files. We both annotate them. We share those files with each other. And on the actual day of the climb, we have slightly different roles. I'm definitely more of the navigator. I have a really good mental image of the topography and the features, terrain features. I can identify topography really well. So it helps us continue moving forward without constantly checking the GPX file, which sometimes you have to do anyway. And then decision-making on the trail is kind of a joint effort as well. So most of it's shared responsibility.
Okay. So who's in charge of the snacks?
Well, so we bring our totally own snacks. Like, everyone, like, we pack the same things. Like, having duplicates in each pack is always a good choice.
Yeah, different philosophies on snacks.
Yeah, totally different.
You know,
snacks.
I don't tend to eat very much at all on climbs, but we're getting to the point in our climbing career where there isn't enough, you know, calories in the bloodstream sometimes, and it's important to just take a break and eat a little bit. I'm terrible at eating before, so during, and after, so I have to rely on, you know, gels and goos and blocks and just the high glucose, high carb stuff. To keep me going throughout the day. But I mean, there are a lot of 12-hour climbs where I didn't eat anything.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm diabetic. And if I don't, and I don't usually eat in the mornings, but I've had to start, like, on hiking and backpacking trips, I have to have a breakfast or I'm trashed.
Right. And that's the reality. In the winter, we're often not camping, you know, because it's terrible. So we're driving up at, you know, midnight, 1 a.m., and I'll have 3-4 hours to sit there in the car and try to get a bagel. And, you know, I like chocolate milk. I'll do a liter or quart of chocolate milk in the morning and try to get at least 1,500, 2,000 calories in me before we start climbing. And that helps a lot for sure. But it's still difficult.
So not so much as you as a couple, but let's say you're in a group. Have you ever had any moments mid-climb or mid-adventure where you've had disagreements with other members of the party, and how did you handle it?
Yeah, I mean, generally, it's really nice to go with people who you know, like you've done this with them before, you really trust them. So sometimes you have discussions beforehand where it's like, hey, you know, we can, most of this is a shared venture, but maybe this person has to be back in Denver by 5. So they may go ahead and be like, hey guys, I may have to bail early, just letting you know. But we have had a couple times where we've been in a group and we have disagreed, and it was, I don't think it was handled well in general. If you're, we shouldn't have probably split up in this case. But Ryan and I ended up going on, and then we ended up meeting them back down the trail later, and it was pretty obvious they were pretty frustrated, and we felt frustrated with them, you know, wanting to turn around. I think in a group, we probably should have had more discussions at the car or like on the way up until we got to this big decision point where it was like, oh, we are on completely different pages. All four of us are not communicating well. It helps to just talk beforehand, I believe should.
Yeah, I think the communication was really poor. Yeah. I think they were dramatically underperforming based on what we'd seen from them in the past.
Well, they had time constraints that weren't their fault. Like,
yeah, there was a lot going on with them that I think we couldn't account for. And I don't think we made the wrong decision or anything like that, but I think they made the wrong decision in going with us on that particular objective. They weren't committed. They expected us to, you know, bail at a point where I couldn't bail. They decided that I would go down this steep, loose, snowy gully and explore, see how the route looked. And I got down there and I said, yeah, it's great, let's go, you know, and they decided, no, we're going to turn around. And I couldn't up climb it really. I mean, I could have, I suppose, but I was pretty committed at the point. So it was stupid. It was, I think, yeah, Everybody's fault.
We should have just talked it through like earlier on before we got to this point. Like if you're already things we that should have been communicated hours ago. I mean, there's been other times where we've been in a group of three and someone's had to turn around, which is usually the worst case. One case, it was, you could see the trailhead and it was on a road, so we felt comfortable and we discussed it beforehand, but it still was hard for the person. They kind of weren't in that boat. They didn't really think like, oh, I'm going to be hiking this stretch by myself. So, yeah.
Yeah. And that gets harder with a wider discrepancy of experience levels, too. We're climbing with people who have done 300, 400 13ers, and, you know, maybe we've only done shy of 200. We can still mutually trust that we're making the smart decision, whatever it may be.
Yeah, there's been times where they've gone,
it's been a no-brainer that we decide to split up and they go off and run three more summits and catch us before we get back to the car. And we never question, are they going to get back safely? Yeah. You know, it gets easier, but we've had a few with, you know, newer climbers and people who overstate their abilities, and it just hasn't turned out well for them.
Has these adventures mountaineering ever tested y'all's relationship?
I wouldn't say it's ever seriously tested our relationship.
I think maybe a little early on, because there were a couple of times where like I had to descend alone or I had to bail alone once. And it was like, this is horrible.
We were both immature, like, you know. We didn't know what we were doing. And we probably got pretty pissed at each other a few times. But, you know, basically.
Hey, that makes a relationship stronger.
Yeah, down the road when you work out those issues, absolutely.
Yeah. So this question is for each of you. Kara, you go first. What is one of your favorite shared memories in the mountains with Ryan?
It was our first backpacking trip. I still hate backpacking, by the way. I don't enjoy it. It is a means to an end for me. But this was the first time. I didn't even have a sleeping pad. I borrowed one from his parents. It was like child size, like way too short. I had an enormous sleeping bag, just like massive. I think the approach was maybe like 2.5 miles. I think the approach was only like 2.5 miles, and it took us like all day to get there for some reason. Like, I was so slow. exceeded everything. It was buggy. Where we camped was South Colony Lakes. Like, there, it's a really busy area. There are people everywhere. So it was like a horrible start to everything. And then it was a Monday. So then we ended up alone. Most of the other people had then left, and we got completely off route. It was on Crestone Needle. It's notorious for route finding. We got completely off route. We didn't know that the route we were on absolutely went, and we would have been fine. But by some miracle, there was a guy on the ridge crest, and we yelled up to him. We were like, "Hey, we don't really know where we are. You know, does this go down here?" And he yelled down. He's like, "Oh yeah, just go straight up." Like, it was just the weird. It was like almost surreal that there's this other person there. And it was really horrible. Like, there are multiple times where we were like, should we turn around? Like, are we at a point where this is no longer an option? We decided, like, no, like, you know we know we at least can get there. And we got to the summit, and we were both like, that was so bad. We need to get back. Like, we still have to go to our tent, pack up all of our crap. Like, this is so bad. Everything is bad, and we're alone. We don't know where our nice guy went. I think he appeared on the summit for a little bit. We talked to him. He was like, okay, you know, for your descent route, if you want to go down, you know, the standard normal route, this is where your crossover point was. And he was great at explaining. And we were like, oh, okay. So we were like, okay, let's just like shove food in our mouth and like go or whatever. It's like, I literally shoved a handful of almonds from my pack, and I turned to Ryan and I was like, you're ready? And he is down on one knee with the ring that I had given him like a year and a half ago to propose.
What?
Yes. So yeah, he proposed to me on the summit, and then we had to have a horrible hike out.
Can you imagine if you couldn't find the summit, or, you know, like, what was plan B?
Well, he brought the ring.
I'd had
it
on other climbs. Yeah.
We did a vacation, and he brought it all the way to Scotland and Iceland. Didn't propose.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know how many trips he'd carried the ring on before.
A lot.
Asking the question. But for whatever reason, now it's one of my favorite memories, even though it was like kind of objectively terrible all the time.
That's awesome. That's a wonderful story. Ryan, what about you?
I don't really have anything that tops that, to be honest. That was a good memory for sure. It was interesting and memorable. And Crestone Needle is still one of our favorite 14ers. We've done it. I think I've been at the summit three times. Gear's been up there twice. It's a really, really aesthetic peak, a really unique peak. And at the time, it was a really lofty objective for us. I think it was one of the earlier serious class three climbs we'd done. In reality, it's more class four-ish.
Yeah,
they call it class four now.
Yeah.
But it has a lot of rescues and deaths and things. So it was an intimidating peak, and it was an uncomfortable experience through and through. But it was the perfect time to propose, I suppose.
That's awesome.
But other than that, I just say the normal ups and downs and some
just
uniquely amazing experiences. And, you know, it's not a particularly unique memory, but just are the two trips again that we've done with. What is the
CMH?
Canadian Mountain Holidays. Yeah. Yes. Those are pretty incredible.
Those have been just super memorable.
The scenery is unbelievable. The lodging's amazing. Food's amazing. Climbs are amazing. I mean, really hard to beat it.
So you're in the mountains and you have an objective. Let's say it's just you two. Do you ever get into a situation where something pops up and go, oh, you know, I want to go do that, or I want to go see that, and then the other person doesn't want to do it? Meaning that, do you all ever split up, or is it, if you are together, you are together, and it's a joint decision? If we go do a side quest, either we do it together or we don't.
I mean, we've split up a few times for reasons just like that. Like, there was one time I got injured and I couldn't do the traverse on the Crestones, and I knew Ryan had the skill set. There was multiple parties ahead. I was like, you go ahead. Like, I'm injured. I'm not going to risk it anymore for me. On skiing objectives, we split up a few times where I'm like, hey, you know, I'm comfortable skiing this section. Ryan's like, I'm going to boot down, you know, we'll stay in touch. We have radios now, so that makes it really easy if, you know, I want to ski down and he's, you know, up above me or something. Every now and then, but usually no.
I think it's our general philosophy. We don't add unexpected objectives. Sometimes we cut things short, but we plan for the longest day that we might be in for. And if we need to not do that one unranked peak out there, or hey, this day is taking twice as long as we expected, that other peak's going to have to wait for a different trip, then generally we're on the same page and we're going to come down together, because the reason we're not doing it is in the interest of time or daylight or conditions, et cetera. So it's pretty rare that we end up splitting up, but it's always a small inconsequential, hey, you go down first, I'm going to boot this and then put on skis, or, you know, hey, all right, yeah, you can go over to that other sub summit and I'll see you in 10 minutes. It's never anything big.
For team Kira and Ryan, Kira, what strengths do you bring to the team?
I tend to over-prepare and cross-reference.
So you save Ryan's ass a lot with stuff?
I mean, normally it's on the front end. A lot of the pre-work is sometimes I'm very much like in the discussion of like, what are all the variables that we're going to face this weekend or this trip or whatever. I generally bring a larger portion of that, and then Ryan can talk down some of them like, no, we do not need to be worried about that. That's silly. I'm pretty good at pace. I can usually maintain a steady pace for a very long time. You know, I don't really stop a lot, which some people that doesn't jive with, which is fine. Everybody kind of has their own break schedule. Mine tend to not exist. So I'm comfortable, you know, going ahead and scoping things out and like calling back like, hey, this went, or I'm going to go up there, see what it looks like and wait. I'm usually pretty good about that.
Yeah, I'm definitely not as good at pace. I tend to just go really fast, get lost in my own world, and then I'm puffing and puffing, and I don't know where anyone is. So it's helpful to have to pace me. I'd say my skill set complements Kira's pretty well.
You're great at maps.
I'm navigation. I would say I'm generally very good at packing and bringing the right things. Not everything. Kira's rolling her eyes at me, but I tend to carry the heavier pack as well. So if we're doing a winter backpacking trip, you know, we have a Hilleberg Steika tent. It's like over 9 pounds. So I'm generally carrying the fabric part, and maybe Kira has the poles. Setting up camp, tearing down camp, just
way better
trying to maintain a not necessarily positive, but at least steady level of morale when it's really miserable, I'm generally good at. So I think that contributes positively to our successes. We're both good at pushing forward when it's horrible, wet bushwhack through willows and hail and rain and who knows what else, or sleepless nights and still getting up and doing those summits. We're both good at a lot of the same things.
Nice. So I like this question. Any advice, or what advice would you give to other couples who want to get into, I mean, it could be hiking, backpacking, mountaineering, any kind of lessons learned along y'all's journey?
I mean, I don't know that our approach was the only right approach, but I think learning together is really helpful. I started resort skiing when I was a kid, but Kira hadn't skied until like 4 years ago and started doing backcountry. Was it 3 years ago? Which was shortly after.
You only started skiing 3 years ago, and you're posting the ski stuff that you're doing now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it helps learn together.
Right, but I'd never done backcountry either, and we'll both tell you that when you get into ski mountaineering, no amount of resort competence can really prepare you adequately for it. It's totally different gear. The boots are lighter. The skis are lighter. They're chattery. They're not as maneuverable. It's a whole different thing. The snow is less predictable. Just predicting what the snow is going to do throughout the day, or predicting what the snow is like before you go to the mountains, is really, really challenging sometimes. And timing it correctly is very difficult. And all of those variables add up to a really miserable experience most of the time while you're learning. It might look cool for 100 feet for an Instagram video, but the rest of it, you're just making ugly turns the whole way down and hating life. But sometimes it's the right tool for the job, which is why we picked it up, because they have a lot more flotation than snowshoes. You can make a much faster descent if the conditions are good. And yeah, a lot of other reasons, but yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the couples like we know that have gotten really into rock climbing, and like usually one starts out a little bit, you know, more competent or more experienced, but most couples that we know that have picked up a skill together, like it usually evolves into another new skill that you then both learn together, which is really cool. Like we have friends where they're both really competent rock climbers in different ways. One was more into scrambling, one was more into the gym, but then they both kind of are getting more into canyoneering, a new skill to both of them together. So if you're a couple, like I think just being open to trying new things together, like you may end up really liking it. And then you get to both learn a new skill, which is really cool.
And it's funny, I just released part 4 with Brandon. He's an AMGA guide. So he has the alpine, the rock, and ski, and wow. He specializes in the ski. Yeah, he said exactly what you just said. He goes, you know, you see these people posting the ski stuff on Instagram, and it's awesome 3 turns in the powder, and then the rest of it, they don't post because it's just shit.
Right.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, especially in the Pacific Northwest, we learned that on Shasta. We were like, oh my God, the snow here is so bad.
Yeah. So it's just so funny because we recorded that last night and I edited it and dropped it this morning or this afternoon. And he said the exact same that y'all said. So that's, to me, it's kind of funny. You get up to a summit, you got your skis on. What thought process or what's discussed to say, yes, we go down, or wait, this is, you know, too risky due to avalanche and this and that. Like, how does that work?
I mean, the avalanche concern is much bigger on the way up because you're exposed to that terrain for a lot longer and you're moving much slower and you don't have any quick egress if something does start to slide. When you're going down the hill, I mean, small slides you can outrun or ski out of potentially, depending on the conditions.
Yeah, or the terrain.
But yeah. Either way, you've got your downhill skis on. And on the way up, you don't. And it's also the first time you're in that terrain. And again, you're in it for a lot longer. So your risk assessment for avalanches has to happen on the way up and not really on the way down. The way down is straightforward. You go down. And you can talk about skiing as a group or splitting up a little bit to reduce exposure to potential slide paths. But if you're on the summit and you're really questioning whether you should ski down, then you should not be on the summit.
Or if you're on the summit too early, like let's say it's like, oh my God, the snow is so hard. Sometimes it's like, oh, you know what? It's really nice. Let's just wait it out. Or you may be like, let's go down a little bit and wait it out down low.
Right. That's a bigger discussion is how are we going to time the snow well? What is the snow going to be doing? What snow is subjected to wind right now? Do we think it's going to soften up soon? Is it going to be too late when that softens? At the bottom is mashed potatoes and it's going to be a horrible egress. You know, how is this going to be the smoothest descent possible? And it's very difficult to time because usually it's too, well, in Colorado or really any mountain where you're planning on skiing 4,000, 5,000 feet of snow, climate changes a lot in those thousands of feet, as does, you know, potentially the aspect, the amount of wind that it's been subjected to, the number of hours of sun that it's had. Temperatures last night were much colder at the summit than they were 4,000 feet lower. So it's always a question of how are we going to make this the most advantageous for us to make a smooth getaway. And generally, it's bad in at least parts of it. And it's potentially really good in parts of it if you time it right.
My only real experience on the snow is at Rainier and, you know, walking down, we parked at Paradise and we're walking up to Mir snowfields and man, it's like, you're exactly right. Like for me, it was shocking the difference in when we started, how the snow was so hard and then over an hour or so it's softening up. And then, you know, John's like, hey, don't walk next to the trees because you could fall through because it's like 30 feet of snow. You could fall through and die. And I'm like, what?
Oh, great.
And then we're crossing this, I don't know, like this little canyon area, like that steep part to get up to Muir Snowfields. And he's like, yeah, this is where the avalanches happen. So, you know, we need to be, I'm like, Ava, what? I'm like, where are you taking me? Like, yeah. And then the, you know, death part never got brought up, but I had a three part episode with him on what it kind of means to hike and backpack in Washington. And he goes, yeah, that part we were traversing when I was telling you to look up and there were some cracks in the snow. And he goes, you know, that's sometimes people have died there. And I'm like,
the hazards there are way greater than here in terms of snow things that can happen to you. I mean, they don't have as much avalanche, but they have crevasses and like bursts, things we don't have.
Yeah.
Totally different game up there.
So speaking of avalanche, have y'all had any like kind of training and stuff of how to recognize that kind of stuff or?
Yeah, we've done an Aries 1 course with San Juan Expeditions, and that was an excellent course. It was more ski-oriented. They didn't allow slow-shoers, just skiers. So it was about how to identify and avoid, you know, basic avalanche problems, but also how to find really good skiing. So it was a good course for what we do. Again, we're really risk-averse. We're not trying to push the envelope on avalanche terrain. If it doesn't look objectively very safe, we're not going to subject ourselves to it. And we have adequate knowledge to correctly identify those problems. And in Colorado, we have the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, the CAIC, and they issue a daily forecast, and it has a forecast for that day and the following day. And they gather an immense amount of information, give really good observations, and tell you exactly what problems there are, where they are, and what to look out for. And that's not, you know, to be trusted absolutely, but it can at least give you a good hint of places you should avoid.
Okay. Have you ever seen an avalanche?
We did. Yeah, it was pretty early on in our climbing careers. We went to Chasm Lake on Long's Peak in the spring, and we were pretty late in the day, and we crossed a fairly steep snowfield. If you've done Chasm, you know exactly what snowfield it is. That slope slid like 15 minutes after we crossed over it. And then we had to cross back over the avalanche debris. It was loud. It was a fairly significant loose wet slide, and it would have been really consequential if we were under it, but it did cross over the trail. We had to climb over it on the way out. And that was the only time that we've encountered that. And we were pretty cautious before and after that. But, you know, we didn't really have the knowledge or the skill set or anything to be doing that when we did. That was probably over 15 years ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen other small slides, but we've never, you know, been adjacent to anything like a big slide.
Yeah, we've definitely never been in avalanche terrain when similar terrain has slid, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that damn Long's Peak. So, any gear failures on y'all's adventures or freezing moments that you'll never forget?
Well, I already mentioned the sleeping pad failure on Hagerman. That was so probably bad. One of the worst gear failures we've ever had.
Well, one time he brought one of my shoes and one of his shoes.
Yes.
And that wasn't even the reason we turned around that day.
Yeah, I got her mountaineering boot and my mountaineering boot. One was left and one was right, so it still worked. But, yeah.
You actually wore it?
Yeah, I just put on like the four pairs of socks. And then it was really windy and we turned around and it had nothing to do with the boots being not mine.
That's awesome.
I was very mad in the car.
Yeah. What else?
I mean, my family lives in Hawaii. And I don't know if this is like a my family or a me problem, but like there's been so many hikes where Ryan or my dad is like sewing the soles of our shoes back together, or we've just like, all right, I guess it's barefoot hiking now because my shoe is completely disintegrated.
because the humidity melts the glue. Yeah. And they live there for, you know, a year at a time without being worn. And they put them on, they're fine. And then 15 minutes into an 8-hour hike, both of the sandals are stuck in the mud 20 feet back there.
No way. And so do you turn around or you just keep going?
There was one time I had a little pocket knife and I cut holes in the soles and I wove the shoelaces through and tied them back on.
It worked.
And it did work well enough. And yeah, I mean, you don't really need shoes in Hawaii anyway. So yeah. It's fine.
It happens to my parents all the time where it's like, okay, clearly this isn't a me problem, but it might be a my family problem.
So how do you mentally prepare for you just know when you get into the winter and in the mountains, it's just going to be it's not going to be comfortable. How do you mentally prepare for that?
I mean, fortunately, because we're doing it every weekend, we get to ease into it a little bit.
Okay.
So it does tend to get fairly cold getting into October, November. November, there are usually intermittent snowfall that doesn't stick. So that gives us an opportunity to get out there in kind of cold, unfavorable conditions and then just keep pushing through it. Generally, we don't hike every single weekend in the winter. We just hike every, you know, try to do, again, one every weekend on average. But, of course, we're averaging much higher than one a week in the summer and lower in the winter. So in the winter, typically we'll do a trip out to Hawaii, right, or you know, do a trip to a hot spring or a 10th Mountain Division hut out here in Colorado and not do a climb if the weather's looking unfavorable.
Yeah, we try to have more things to look forward to in the winter because it's just terrible.
It's hit or miss, probably realistically every other weekend in the winter. But again, we try to choose aspects on mountains that are not going to be as prone to the wind. So typically something on like a north or east slope or ridge. We try to choose things that are shorter. Just saving some shorter objectives for winter is something that we always do. We have a running list. This is a potential list, everything we want to do this calendar winter. And we always have leftover peaks. So there are a few that we'll consider this winter and so on. Again, trying to keep the objectives reasonable and short and simple.
So do you have any, out of the bazillion peaks in Colorado, do you have some that you favor more in the winter or favor more in the summer, or like, hey, winter's coming up. I'm really excited to tackle this one in the winter.
Yeah, we just keep an eye out for what other people have done. And if it looks reasonable, we'll add it to our list. There are a ton of peaks in Colorado that have really, really loose rock, but they have great couloir climbs in the winter or spring. So we try to just keep tabs on which peaks are actually more favorable in the winter. Obviously, trailhead access is a huge factor. Some of them get dramatically longer when you can't get to the trailhead. And we just try to keep tabs on those and, keep a running list. Yeah.
It's nice to have more experienced friends where you can kind of like follow along with them and be like, okay, they did that this weekend, so maybe I'll put that away in my head for next winter. Like, it's really nice to have a lot of experienced people that you're in touch with that are kind of doing the hard part of figuring out if it goes for you.
Right. Just spending time going through. One of our best sources for information for peaks is just trip reports on 14ers.com because they have trip reports for every 13er as well as 14ers. So going through those and seeing what skied well, what didn't ski well, what was easy in the winter, what wasn't, what problems did they have, and either adding them to our winter list or crossing them off the winter list and saying this is a summer peak definitely helps. But there are a ton of peaks that are easier in the winter or spring than they are in the summer.
So have you ever had a moment? Because, you know, like for me, you always hear when you're hiking and backpacking in Colorado, weather, weather, weather. If you're going to be at elevation, you want to be below tree line, you know, before noon or because of thunderstorms and stuff. So have you ever been in a situation where the weather surprised you and put you in a kind of a dangerous situation? I see a smile, so there should be some good stories coming up.
Nothing too wild. Yeah, Tabawash and Chavano, that it was probably within the first 15 summits that we did. We spent way too long. It's difficult because you have to go up over the first one, then summit, then come back up over the first one. So it's easy to underestimate. It's a lot of time above 13,000 feet, and it's a lot of vertical feet, probably more than we'd done on any particular climb leading up to that. So we underestimated the weather. We were just way too late in the day, got summit fever, decided we were going to go for the second peak. You can't do the second peak easily without, again, repeating the first. And just seemed like such a big commitment. We got summit fever and continued to push on. And then getting back down to the saddle, there was thunder, not that much lightning. Actually, I'd say no lightning.
There was lightning at that point.
Maybe a little bit. But either way, it wasn't horrendous knowing what we know now. But it was enough that we decided we were going to go down this other unnamed gully down and hopefully get to the Colorado Trail. And it just didn't go well. Morale was extremely low. In reality, I don't think we were in any significant danger.
I fell.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah, Kira fell, but I mean, from the weather, we should have continued down the standard route and just gone up and over the first summit, or descended and waited a few hours and then gone back up.
Yeah, that's what we probably should have done.
You know, we just wanted to get out of it at that point. We weren't being very constructive with each other. And I did end up calling 911 and just saying, hey, my phone's almost dead, because my phone was almost dead.
So many mistakes.
I think this was before smartphones. In any case, they were able to ping my phone. They were really helpful. And they said, hey, you're only 1.5 miles from the Colorado Trail. Just keep going down. People do this every week.
Yeah,
don't worry
about it.
Follow
the river. Like, it's going to be bad, but if you follow the river, you're going to get to
the trail. I didn't really need their assistance. I just wanted them to know where we were so that if we were way overdue, they would know where to start looking. But it wasn't life-threatening. We've had, you know, run-ins with unexpected lightning and thunder and clear forecast, but out of nowhere, a little cloud comes along and my pulse starts buzzing. You know,
like,
it's
that's
weird.
Not good.
But nothing that I would really do differently other than Tabawash and Chavano.
Yeah, Wilson. I mean, that one was really surprising. Like, we were on the summit and it was still sunny, and then all of a sudden we heard thunder and we were like, really? And then you could just see behind us the sky darkening. And it was it just built so fast. Like, we didn't see anything going up that was any sort of red flag. And it was like, I think it was before 10 a.m. Like, it was really early.
Do people die with lightning strikes and stuff? And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today, and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.